You're listening to Dr. Finn Pollard and colleagues on Siren FM with Past Prologue.
The word is about, there's something evolving. Whatever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
And the title for Volume 3 of Past Prologue is the intriguing Mad Kings and Bad Kings, Finn.
Yes, this is a riff off an article that came out in the New Republic in February, actually talking about Donald Trump. There'd been a lot of discussion about Trump's mental state and making comparisons between Trump and George III and earlier monarchs of questionable...
Can't see Nigel Hawthorne somehow doing a Donald Trump, really. Not from his present position, anyway.
No.
However, that's the theme of the whole programme, and as ever, you've got not only your good self, but three magical historians to actually lend the quality of debate to a whole range of things as we move backwards in time.
We're going to start today by talking to Dr. Ed Owens about Edward VIII. We're then going to move back to the era of the English Civil War with Dr. Jonathan Fitzgibbons, and we're going to finish up with a returning guest, Dr. Antonella Liuzzo Scorpo, giving us a medieval angle on Mad Kings.
And with his Connecticut Yankees, we're launching musically at least with Rudy Valley.
I could show the world how to smile. I could be glad all of the while. I could change the gray clouds to blue if I had you. I could leave the old days behind, leave all my pals, I never mind. I could start my life all anew if I had you. I could climb the snow-capped mountains, sail a mighty ocean wide. I could cross the burning desert if I had you by my side. I could be a king, dear, uncrowned, humble or poor, rich or renowned. There's just nothing I couldn't do if I had you. Show the world how to smile. I could be glad all of the while. I could change the gray clouds to blue if I had you. I could leave the old days behind, leave all my pals, I never mind. I could start my life all anew if I had you. I could climb the snow-capped mountains, sail the mighty ocean wide. I could cross the burning desert if I had you by my side. I could be a king, dear, uncrowned, humble or poor, rich or renowned. There's just nothing I couldn't do if I had you.
So, I hope that's helped to transport you mentally back to the dance halls of the 20s and 30s and to begin to think about the first of our problem kings, shall we say. I'm turning to Dr. Ed Owens. and the subject of Edward VIII. And I thought I'd start by asking you, can you say a little bit about who he was?
Well, most famously, Finn. He is the king that is remembered for abdicating the throne, famously, in 1936, creating a constitutional crisis, which was resolved when his brother acceded to the throne, King George VI, who was the father of our present queen, Queen Elizabeth II. An interesting figure because of his kingly qualities or lack thereof. Born at the end of the 19th century in 1894, and very much sought to modernise the monarchy in terms of how he behaved. He is memorable, really, because he was, if you like, the first mass media royal, benefited a great deal from exposure in the popular press, in newsreels, on the radio waves, and he was the first global celebrity who was royal. He wanted to modernise monarchy and did so through these new forms of media. Very different character, I must hasten to add, from his father, King George V, and his mother, Queen Mary of Teck, originally. He and his father had a very bad relationship. His father was very much a Victorian relic, emphasis on duty, on self-sacrifice, on the sort of common, on every man's sort of understanding of what kingship was. Edward wanted to modernise that through new cultures of celebrity. He was a renowned dancer. He was a famed lover of sports cars, anything that went fast, especially women, and had numerous affairs, most notably, of course, with Wallis Simpson, which began in the early 1930s and led eventually to his abdication in 1937.
So was it the case that when he first comes to the throne with all this sort of modernising agenda and ideas for change, is he a popular figure? Is this seen as a promising moment for the monarchy? Or is it clear that there are going to be problems from the moment he accedes?
Well, he's a very, very popular figure. It's difficult, I think, really to comprehend the level of his popularity. I don't think any royal is probably ever compared since. Not even his niece, our current queen, would have compared in terms of her popularity. That's because ever since he sort of turned 16, reaching sort of maturity, he has been used by politicians and the royal household alike to popularise monarchy. He's done, in 1911 we have famously have his investiture as the Prince of Wales at Carnarvon Castle, which was an event orchestrated by David Lloyd George, and he is elevated as a symbol of England and Wales coming together, of Britishness on a national scale, and it's a mass media event. Again, he's a popular symbol of, if you like, the wartime youth who go and fight in the trenches between 14 and 18 and is presented as such in the mass media. And the royal family are keen to press this image. And in the 20s and 30s, he's touring the empire. He's, on behalf of his father, he is the royal ambassador of his father, going to places as far-flung as Australia, Africa, New Zealand, North America, visiting the outposts of empire, engaging with the veterans who fought during the First World War, engaging with the wives and children of empire. And it's as a result of these interactions and the accompanying media coverage that he really takes on this modern celebrity role as the most well-known person in the world. So there's a great deal of excitement when he comes to the throne at the start of 1936, when his father dies in January 1936, about the potential that he represents and the modernising agenda that he seems to embody in terms of his popular imagery.
So what goes wrong then? I mean, is it very much a consequence of his liaison with Wallis Simpson, as I think popular culture would tend to give us that impression, or are there broader flaws sort of behind this character that become clearer once he's actually in the position?
Well, I think it's fair to say there are two major reasons why Edward VIII abdicates at the end of 1936. It's partly to do with his long-standing liaison with Wallace Simpson. Equally, he isn't a very good king in terms of what kings are expected to do. Kings are expected to behave. They're expected to listen to their ministers. Kings aren't meant to express opinions which might influence politics. Well, Edward had very little time and patience for the rigmarole of the everyday life of kingship. He didn't like opening the red boxes. He had spent very little time with his ministers and overseeing the business of government. But equally, when it became sort of knowledge within elite circles that he had this ongoing romance with Wallis Simpson and that he intended to marry her, Stanley Baldwin, Prime Minister at the time, Cosmo Lang, Archbishop of Canterbury at the time, thought this simply could not do. Here was a king who wanted to marry a woman who was twice divorced, but who had two husbands, crucially, still living. That was the major issue. That had two husbands still living and was intent on marrying her. And it was his absolute commitment to this marriage, no matter what, which led to Stanley Baldwin saying to him, if you marry this twice divorced American woman whose reputation would, which we cannot reconcile, we can not reconcile to, she is sort of an ungodly figure, and she doesn't, she could not be queen consort. If you do not renounce her, then this government will resign. That led to the constitutional crisis arising, because here was a king who was ready to flout the advice of his leading minister, and what we therefore have is this clash of two personalities or several personalities, and he is forced to abdicate in order so that he might marry her, and George VI fulfills that role.
I'm interested in this issue that arises just before that you were mentioning about the way that he's not reading the material in the red boxes, and he's also expressing opinions on things that the monarch is expected sort of not to do. How serious a crisis is that generating before we get to the debate over the possibility of the marriage? Because I think back to the film of Madness of King George, where there is a sense of government sort of grinding to a halt because the king is not there to exercise the function that he would usually perform. And I wonder to what extent is there a similar problem in the mid-30s, or is it a different world?
In the mid-30s, there's certainly the case that it's certainly the case that there is great consternation amongst the private secretaries that this is a man, even before he's become king, who will not be able to fulfil this role and what is expected of him. Partly to do, of course, with the fact that he had all of these love affairs going on, but equally because he didn't at any point seem to really apply himself in this role of king, this sacrifice himself to this particular role, exercise sort of any real interest in the business of government. He was a part-time king. He preferred to go out dancing, drinking until late in the evening. And I think there was a nice anecdote comes from Alan Lascelles, who was his private secretary in the late 1920s. He resigned and then became his private secretary again, actually, when Edward acceded to the throne. But that was that Alan Lascelles had often thought that it would be best for the king, who was an avid horse rider, used to ride in point-to-point races, to fall from a horse and break his neck, because he would never be the king that the British wanted him to be, in terms of that perseverance, that sacrifice of oneself.
hands on your money, 'cause in your dreams a demon screams. I know it's gonna hurt you blind. Some people hunger, fame and fortune all their lives. There's fools in paradise. And I was good for just one day. I would give it all away. I would give it all away for loving you. And I was king for just one day. Diamond rings and all they never sparkle like your smile. And as for fame, it's just a name. It only satisfies you for a while. Oh, some people hunger, fame and fortune all their lives. But they're just fools in paradise.
Was the Thompson Twins with King for a Day. And we're moving back in time now. The abdication crisis was obviously finally resolved peaceably. The problem king that we're going to turn to next produced a much more violent, or led to a much more violent confrontation. So we're going to think now about the events of the English Civil War and the lead up to it and the role played in it by King Charles. And so I'd like to ask John Fitzgibbons, first of all, why was there a civil war, and how significant was the character and conduct of Charles in bringing that on?
OK. Well, like the reign of Edward VIII, the reign of Charles I starts quite well, actually. Charles comes to the throne in 1625, and he's seen as the kind of great new hope for both Protestant England and Protestant Europe. Because this is a time when we've got this major war raging out in Europe, the 30 Years' War, pitting the forces of Catholicism against the Protestants. And Charles's father, James, had been very reluctant to get involved in this war, but when Charles comes to the throne, he's really determined to get stuck in there. And he's backed by a lot of Protestant interest in England, particularly the more radical Protestants called the Puritans. The only snag with all this, though, is that he needs money. You need money to fight a war in this period, as in any period. And Charles turns to Parliament. He's hoping that Parliament are going to give him the money to fight this war. But they won't. Then, as now, people don't like taxation. They don't want to vote money to fight this war. And increasingly, in the early years of his reign, relationships between Charles and his Parliament break down over this issue of granting him money. And by 1629, Charles says, I've had enough of this. I'm going to reign on my own. I'm going to do away with Parliament. And he rules for 11 years without Parliament. And we have this period known to history as the personal rule. Now, during that time, Charles starts to tax people without parliamentary consent. If they refuse to pay his taxes, he puts them in prison without showing any cause for this. He also starts to pursue some kind of reforms in the church that look increasingly like Catholicism. He wants to make the churches look beautiful again inside, and this doesn't really hold well with a lot of Puritan opinion. So he looks increasingly Catholic. So there's a whole kind of change in opinion about Charles from the start of the reign. You know, he goes from being this great Protestant hope to being this almost crypto-Catholic king. And suspicions fester during this personal rule because there is no forum in which people can voice discontent. There's no parliament. Now, matters aren't helped by the fact that Charles isn't a very effective communicator. He likes to sit in his palaces and basically, you know, converse with his courtiers, but he doesn't really seek public opinion. He doesn't really know what's going on outside of London at the time. So he doesn't see all these kind of grievances that are building up in the country. Now, that's fine until 1640, when the money begins to run out. And one of the reasons the money starts to run out is because Charles has rubbed up Scotland the wrong way, of all places. He's tried to pursue these kind of church policies in Scotland to bring them more into uniformity with England, and the Scots rebel. Now, Charles needs money to put down this rebellion, but he just can't raise it. So he has to summon a parliament. And when Parliament meets in 1640, when the English Parliament meets in 1640, the consensus is that Charles is a very bad king. So how are you going to deal with him? How are you going to deal with this bad king? Well, one of the safeguards that are put in place is that Parliament make him pass an act that says he has to summon Parliament every 3 years. You can't have this kind of long reign now without summoning a Parliament. The other thing that they're very keen to ensure that he does is get the right advice. You know, kings have to be advised well. Now, interestingly, one of the reasons why they say Charles has been a bad king up to this point is because he's been taking the advice of these people who they style as the evil counsellors. Now, this is a very effective way of criticising the king without criticising the king. You basically say that it's these people around the king that are feeding him duff information, that are making him do things that he shouldn't. And what you say, therefore, is just get rid of these evil counsellors and then we'll forgive you, basically. Now, whereas Henry VIII, for instance, would just basically drop his counsellors, as he famously does with both Cardinal Wolsey and with Thomas Cromwell, one of Charles's qualities is he's a very loyal person. He's very reluctant to drop his allies. And he kind of sticks with them for far too long. And again, this creates a lot of tension with the people. You know, they start to think like he's a person who can't be trusted. But very reluctantly, he does eventually drop two of these evil counsellors in 1641, the Earl of Strafford and Archbishop William Laud. And so, you know, they start to think, well, everything's OK again. You've got rid of the evil counsellors. Charles is now a reformed character. The real problem, however, is in October 1641, we have another rebellion, this time not in Scotland, but in Ireland. And the key question here is, we're going to have to raise an army to put down this Irish rebellion. And who's going to control that army? Well, traditionally, it should be the king who has command of the armed forces. But there's a growing kind of opinion in Parliament that Charles really can't be trusted. His track record is too iffy to really trust him with this army. And two sides begin to form, two kind of groups begin to form. One that says you can't put these kind of restraints on monarchy. And these increasingly become known as the royalists. You have this other group who say that Parliament should really supervise the king in the command of his army, and this group becomes known as the parliamentarians. And it's over this constitutional issue that you get the ultimate breakdown that leads to a civil war in 1642.
How far do the two sides have models they can call on in thinking about this relationship, this constitutional relationship?
Models in turn.
I'm sort of thinking, you know, when, for example, Charles instigates the personal rule, is that in itself, I suppose, almost a revolutionary step in terms of the way constitutional arrangements have operated? Or is it something that he could fit into a pattern of royal government in Britain that would made it easier to justify?
Well, I think part of the problem is that it would have been very, you know, it would have been easy to do this maybe 200-300 years ago, before Charles's time, to rule without Parliament. But Parliament has become a kind of fixture in the kind of constitutional, well, it's become part of the constitutional furniture of England in the 16th century. The Tudors rely on Parliaments a lot. I mean, they're calling Parliaments pretty regularly, as does James I. And it's almost, you know, Charles kind of subverts that model by stopping having parliaments for so long.
So it obviously, the relationship breaks down and we move into this period of very bloody civil war, which eventually the parliamentarians are victorious in. And as most people probably know, then they have this problem of what to do with the king at the end of that time. And of course they end up with the decision to try him and execute him. How difficult is that, and what do you know? Are there other options they have to avoid that eventuality?
Well, I mean, during the Civil War, there's the hope that you can just negotiate with Charles. And time and again, Parliament keep coming to Charles with peace terms, hoping that he will negotiate. The problem with that is that Charles just tends to spin out these negotiations, and he's never really sincere about coming to a deal with Parliament. All the time, he's trying to raise a new army to start another civil war. And what really does for Charles in the end is that, so the First Civil War ends in 1646 after a crushing victory by the parliamentarians over the royalists. And so by 1648, however, Charles has negotiated a kind of deal with the Scots. He raises another army that comes into England in 1648. You get a second civil war. A lot of parliamentarians have had enough of this. You know, he's going against God's judgment, is what they say. You know, God's judgment was clear in the First Civil War. The king lost. He should come to terms. By starting his second civil war, they say that he's guilty of all the bloodshed in both civil wars, basically. Particularly, it's the radical elements in Parliament who are really pushing this idea of Charles's blood guilt, not least people like Oliver Cromwell, you know, the kind of generals in the parliamentarian army. Now, some options, there were options, though. You didn't have to execute Charles I. And some of the options that were discussed is just merely deposing Charles and maybe putting a kind of puppet king on the throne instead. And they do have an option there in that they do have in captivity the 8-year-old youngest son of Charles I, who they hope they can put on the throne and use as a puppet king. Now, the only problem with this, though, is that you've still got the awkward problem of Charles I there, who can be used as a kind of rallying point for royalism, you know, and so it's very messy. And so what they decide in the end is it's just best to get rid of Charles I altogether.
The Rock Train, leaving the station every other Thursday, 8 till 10, bringing you the best local and international bands from the world of rock and metal. The Rock Train. No tracks are too heavy.
So, before the trail there, we heard Rainbow's Kill the King, an apt musical number, I think, to follow on from a discussion on Charles I and the trial and execution of Charles I. And we're moving back still further now into medieval times as we turn to speak to Antonella. And I want to start off this segment by asking you, what makes a good or bad king in that period?
So, thank you for the question, which is going to summarize decades of historiography and historiographical debates on kinship. I think, first of all, it is important to understand, and this is partially where historiography has been debating a lot, what is kinship and what is the king, and whether you can talk about kinship as an institution as something different from the king as a person, and therefore when you can openly criticize a bad king, that is not really going to threaten the institution of kinship as such. But also how medieval kings are a little bit of everything together. So they are war leaders, they are the most important, if you like, members of the elite, of the aristocracy. They are also representative of God on earth, which is, I think, the most, one of the, this idea of sacred kingship. But some of them are considered kind of more mediators. Some think that they even got some kind of divine power themselves. French kings tend to be quite good at claiming, for example, that they have thaumaturgical powers, so they can touch people and cure people just by posing their hands on them, etc., etc. But it's also important to emphasize how kings are those who administer justice. And so the association between law, justice, and kinship that is very strong, is very key, and it is central. And last but not least, they are those who collect and impose taxes, and administration of money becomes central to judge whether you are being a good ruler or not. So I think in a nutshell, what you then have is, on the one hand, either, which is interesting because you notice the medieval kings tend to have kind of nicknames associated to them, and a lot of them across Western Europe are, you find a lot of wise kings, you find a lot of saint kings, a lot of chaste kings as well. And on the other hand, there's this idea of, okay, but what are those key characteristics that define the perfect king, and what are instead those elements that kind of signal that those might become tyrants? And there are even extensive treatises, like the very famous John of Salisbury, talking about the risks of a bad king actually turning very easily into a tyrant, and so on. And so it's a matter of having skills to administer all the different spheres we've been talking about, but also it's a matter of moral virtues, moral standings, and those models tend to come to kings through different means, especially, and there's this very famous medieval sources called Mirror of Princes, which are basically this treatise about what is the what makes the perfect king, and these are usually didactic manuals that, in principle, young princes and then kings have to kind of follow in a way, for those models to emulate.
And does this produce mainly a stable situation for kings? Are they usually more often successful than not in navigating these competing requirements? Or is it, you know, do you more often see kings being overthrown, kings falling short of the ideal, you know, that, so that these things like the chaste, the good, the wise are more propaganda than reality?
Exactly. I think one of the most important things is that, even more importantly, I would say, than kinship, is the image and the representation of kinship that you are giving. So all those models are actually there to present this kind of perfect and the ideal king. How then you operate in reality my change and my varied. So, for example, if I can bring in the model of my favourite king ever, who's Alfonso X of Castile. He reigned in the 13th century. To give just a very, very brief context for those who might not be that familiar with the lovely and sunny and warm Iberian Peninsula.
Nice place to think about.
Yeah,
the weather
at the moment, exactly. By the mid of the 13th century already, what we have in Iberia is a situation where, apart from a tiny enclave, which is the Kingdom of Granada, which is still under Nasrid and therefore Muslim control, the rest of the peninsula has been taken over or retaken over by Christian leaders. So what you have is the Kingdom of Portugal, Castile and León under Alfonso X and James I of Aragon controlling the eastern side of the peninsula. Now, Alfonso X is an interesting, perhaps one of the most famous kings in medieval Iberia, and his gas renown has how the learned or the wise king for his cultural achievements. He actually used cultural artifacts as means of propaganda and to strengthen this idea of a united Christian kingdoms. He started using the vernacular as a language of administration. He's a devout Christian himself and so on and so on. Interestingly, he presents himself not as God on earth, but as a vicar of God. And so it's very interesting because he clearly distinguished himself also for many contemporary French kings because in some miracle story, it talks about the fact that he directs his subject to the shrine of the Virgin Mary or the shrine of Santiago because he doesn't have thaumaturgical powers. So it's interesting because he's giving a model, but without an achievable model, somebody that people can somehow relate with in a more direct way. However, he's also renowned for having had a lot of troubles, mostly because he he claimed the title of emperor on the basis of his maternal line because his mother was of the Hohenstaufen family. So when Frederick II died, he claimed the throne, never achieved that. But in order to pursue this goal, he started imposing taxes and trying to collect money from the nobles who didn't really appreciate that. He tried the same because his aim was not just to reconquer the peninsula, but even extending it into northern Africa. Again, that required money. And again, that was not really the most appreciated thing to do. And he also saw the rebellion of his nobles in 1272 because he tried to impose a legal code which should have unified the pre-existing legislative system. Great idea, but this would have curbed the rights of the nobles, who obviously didn't agree and rebelled. His own son rebelled against him. Again, that's no surprise because if you look around Western Europe, a lot of kings had troublesome sons, never daughters. In some cases it happened, who rebelled against them. So it is very interesting because you can look at the same king from different angles and you can see how he was actually considered, and some historians look at him as a failure in his political endeavors, while he's actually celebrated as perhaps one of the most enlightened kings, Christian kings for Western Europe. And later on, even one of the later 14th century chronicles, which is the only one we actually have about his reign, the Cronica de Alfonso X, tells us that by the end of his days, he turned a little bit mad, but the chronicle also says that that's because of his senile state, and that's why that's what happened. But
king of beasts with quite so little hair.
I'm gonna be the main event like the king was before.
aspiring king.
Oh, I just can't wait to be king.
You've run a long way to go, young master, if you think.
No one's saying do this.
Now, when I said that,
no one's saying be there.
What?
No one's saying stop there.
What you don't
no
realize.
One thinks
that's definitely out.
We don't do it all my way.
I think it's time that you and I arranged a heart-to-heart.
Kings don't need advice from little poor Phil's poor star.
If this is where the monarchy is headed, count me out. Out of service, out of Africa, I wouldn't hang about. Getting wildly out of wing.
Oh, I just can't wait to be king. Everybody look left. Everybody look right. Everywhere you look, I'm standing.
Can't Wait to Be King from The Lion King, showing that these problems of rulership extend into the animal kingdom as well as the human world, possibly, or at least in the world of Disney. So I want to put a question now to the panel as a whole. One of the things that we realised when we'd put this together was that so far we've been talking exclusively, really, about problems with male kings. And of course, there have been female rulers and also consorts of these male kings, some of whom were involved quite closely in the events that we've been talking about. So I wonder whether any of you have views on whether we have similar problems with female rulers, or are the women exempt from these difficulties?
I think if I may start talking about Queen Victoria, it's probably because we've had a preponderance of kings, certainly ruling within the British context, that there have been more problem kings overall. But I would like to refer back to Queen Victoria, a complex figure, not entirely popular throughout her reign, mainly because this was a period in which monarchy, the modern monarchy specifically, was changing a great deal. Over the course of Queen Victoria's reign, what we see is a transition from a monarchy that is actively engaged in political decision-making to a monarchy which is meant to be, at least, constitutional, which is meant to be withdrawn from politics, that maintains the three rights to advise, to respond, and to warn the political ministers. But, of course, she was partial to lots of conversations with Lord Melbourne. She demonstrated a certain political partiality in the early years of her reign. And then after Albert dies, and he was a real political manipulator, she withdraws from politics. And we have the rise of the modern constitutional monarch, who is more withdrawn from politics. But equally, she's then criticised for her lack of visibility. The British public, in this new age of mass media and mass culture, demand to see their queen. And of course, they cannot see their queen. And so we have an abundance of rumours circulating about what the queen is doing, who she is liaising with, who her new certainly partners might be. There's rumours surrounding John Brown, who was her favourite courtier up in Scotland. So visibility in the context, certainly of late 19th century kingship and queenship, is key. And for those not visible, like Queen Victoria, certainly up until her relationship with Benjamin Disraeli, that was a problem.
And yeah, visibility is also a crucial issue, I think, in the Tudor period as well, where we have not just one but two Queen's Regnant. I mean, you wait for one and two come along at once, the live buses. You've got Queen Mary and Queen Elizabeth. And Elizabeth in particular was, you know, she really worked hard to kind of foster this kind of cult around her of kind of Gloriana and, you know, really presenting herself to her people. Very much the exact opposite of Charles I, who was talking about earlier. And in many ways, people used Queen Elizabeth as a kind of yardstick throughout the 17th century to measure other monarchs against, including Charles I, who really fell short there. Also, to go back to Charles I as well, one of these evil counsellors who I was talking about earlier, that's seen as corrupting the king, is his wife, the Queen Henrietta Maria, who is a Catholic queen, and she's seen as being, you know, very heavily influenced in misleading Charles and leading him astray to pursue these kind of arbitrary directions in policy.
Is that also linked, just briefly, with the case of Henrietta Maria, is that also linked to a distrust of women being in roles of political power? Is it very specific to her?
Yeah, I mean, there is something of a distrust of women. I mean, as I say, when you get the first Queen's Regnant in the Tudor period, Mary and Elizabeth, there's a real an emphasis on the fact that they should be governed by their council, their male-dominated Privy Council are the people who should be advising them, and they should be taking the advice of these people. Now, we know that Elizabeth in particular is very, she doesn't like to take the advice of these people. And she is very much her own queen. You know, she does take her own decisions.
Antonella, medieval queens?
Well, yes. Well, a lot of them, it is true that they tend to play the role of, queen consort. They are actually actively ruling in most cases when they act as tutors, so basically before the actual king get to adulthood, when they can actually reign. And it's quite interesting, especially when they have the position of advisors, which is what John was also referring to, because it is significant how they actually actively play the role in some cases of diplomats themselves. We see loads of queens and princesses who even are sent as really diplomats to deal with the different sides. And in some cases, obviously, they are blamed for what happens. But vice versa, there are instead other cases where, quite interestingly, they are presented as those who can bring the king back to wisdom in cases letting passions get into what should be kind of rational negotiation between the parties. In the case of Iberia, we have very different cases and very different examples, and we have a very famous bad, more than queens, she was an infanta, so she was a princess, but the famous Urraca, 12th century, who there are also legends/stories about even his incestuous relationship with her own brother and then future kings, to then move into, farther on down the line in centuries, so then Isabel of Castile, one of the Catholic monarchs, and perhaps with her is when queenship, I would say, gets a very, very, very interesting twist. Ah, and I just mention her, not say anything more, but just to intrigue the listeners, there's a very famous queen called Juana la Loca, which literally means Joan the Mad One. So, yes, there's a little bit of everything for you there.
We could spend a long time pursuing a lot of those examples, I think.
Exactly.
I want to turn, just in the last few minutes, to a slightly broader question, or another broader question, which is, it's clear, I think, from all these cases that throughout history, kingship has been a problematic form of government. And yet it still continues to endure in many places, and in some cases one could suggest that other forms of government nevertheless retain elements of kingship. There's often debate, for example, about the degree to which the American presidency is or is not a sort of form of monarchy. And I wonder if any of you have thoughts about why it is that institutions of monarchy persist despite these problems that arise with them.
I wonder whether I should quote somebody that you know better than me, which is Benjamin Franklin. Didn't he say something like that humankind seems to be kind of prone to having monarchy as part of our kind of DNA? And obviously for the medieval period, it was even inconceivable any other form of government or management, apart from obviously you can look backward at the examples of the city-states and the classical world, and that gives us a very different, or the Roman Republic, and that gives us a slightly different connotation. But I think it's the idea of having a ruling elite, and at the top of the ruling elite, somebody who managed that, that it kind of, it is there and has always been there, and that's why I think that reflects in history and in different periods. Having said that, I do think that there are cultural and political differences when we look at different contexts and different periods that really shape then what you actually mean with kinship.
Of course, in my period, kinship is abolished, but over time it does come back again. And Oliver Cromwell, who becomes Lord Protector, increasingly looks like a king. And as Cromwell himself says, the people do love what they know. And, you know, there's a sense that people really like monarchy, and you just can't get away from that. You still need to style yourself in that way. That's not to say that beneath the surface, the institution of monarchy doesn't evolve over time, even if it still does look very much the same.
Well, and just finally, very quickly, I would say two things, and that is that I think when you have these bad moments of monarchy, specifically within the 20th century, that it's a good reminder of what a bad monarch looks like, but equally what a good monarch should behave like. And it's very much the case that Edward VIII is the foil to his brother, George VI, who succeeds to the throne, and George VI embodies all of those kingly qualities that certainly the establishment want him to embody. And just finally, public relations. Public relations, just to trail my new book, very important to re-establishing monarchy at the centre of society, certainly within the 20th century. And it's certainly the case that George VI benefits from a very savvy public relations team.
Thank you. I want to take this opportunity to thank all the panel again for taking the time to join us today, Dr. Ed Owens, Dr. Antonella Tsiskopo, and Dr. Jonathan Fitzgibbons. I'd also like to thank my colleague Alex Lefchuk from the School of English and Journalism for taking care of the technical side of things, as ever. And just a brief plug for an event coming up in the School of History and Heritage next Thursday, the 4th of May. We have a public lecture given by Eduardo Manzano Moreno from the National Research Council in Madrid, talking about Jews, Christians and Muslims, how we failed to tackle multiculturalism in medieval Iberia. And that will be at 5 p.m. in the David Chittick Building, 1102. And Past Prologue will be back with you in about a month's time. I'm Dr. Finn Pollard. Thank you very much for listening. And you start-